center is Gary Gilmore. Gary is on the steering committee of the competencies, the National Health Educators Competencies Update Project. And for this particular session, we're going to concentrate specifically on how this relates to the profession of school health education. Gary Gilmore.
Thank you, Larry. And I'd like to thank all of the friends and colleagues who are here, current candidates in the program, alumni who are here. It's a small group, but it's a powerful group. And the opportunity that I have today to talk about the National Health Educator Competencies Update Project with school health applications, particularly focusing on professional development, demonstrates, we believe, the application of the national research. And consequently, I'd like to first recognize the co-authors and co-researchers, members of the steering committee, Larry Olson, Allison Taub, and then David Cannell, who was one of the important researchers as a part of the experience. In addition, in mounting a national effort of this magnitude, and we're talking about a six-year research project, 1998 through 2004, with all of the subsequent work that followed, we had representation from across the nation by organizations, representatives from organizations that are health and health education related. And you see the important organizations that were involved related to having representatives on board with our national advisory committee. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail regarding all of the specifics of the research, but I certainly would like to emphasize some key points for context. First up, I'd like to point out that our goal was to establish valid and verified, in other words, vetted competencies based upon empirical research. And we wanted to do it at the entry and advanced levels because competencies had been developed in each of those levels prior to the research. The entry level had been actually verified some 20 years before with the original research. The advanced competencies had not yet been fully vetted. And so it was very important to combine those two purposes in this national research. The other important point that I would make, and it's very germane to this presentation, is that there are three domains of application which are critical. Professional preparation. And since the publication of the document, and I do have a copy of the competencies document here, since the publication of that document and the release of that document in 2006 by the three main organizations that underwrote many of the efforts that we were involved in, the American Association for Health Education, the National Commission for Health Education Credentialing, and also the Society for Public Health Education. Those three entities actually hold the copyright for the data, and they literally represented an important momentum for the research that we conducted on behalf of the profession. Well, with the release of the document in 2006 that had the seven validated areas of responsibility, the 163 subcompetencies which were grouped within 35 competencies, we were able to see those laid out in what was called a hierarchical model that I'll show you in just a moment. But just to set the stage, I want you to know that we went into this research without thinking of a three-step hierarchical model. We thought entry and advanced, and we knew that we would be all about establishing the entry and advanced level competencies. But I want you to know, and I'll state this at this time and when I show you the hierarchical model in just a moment, I want you to know that it was empirical evidence that led to the three levels of entry, Advanced 1 and Advanced 2. And I think that we can really look to that when we went to the practitioners. We can look to that information and build on it in our professional preparation. Consequently, today, programs at the undergraduate level, the bachelor's level, programs at the master's level, and even doctoral programs are now incorporating the competencies to guide and drive their respective programs. And the whole area of professional preparation is a critical starting point. Certification includes not only the under-credentialing, includes not only the certification of health educators, but under the rubric of credentialing, we also have accreditation. And the accreditation standards for the programs also are aligned with the results of the Competencies Update Project. Thirdly, and an area that I'll give you three brief examples about today, professional development and continuing education. So many of us, whether we're CHES certified or not, must keep up our professional development and our continuing education. And those who are CHES certified need to do so, 75 CECH credits over 5 years. And that is very doable, more doable today than when we started the process starting in 1990 with the national exam. What's at the core of the Competencies Update Project? What's at the core of all that we were about collectively? Because some in the room were involved in this effort with us. It wasn't just four individuals on a steering committee with a national advisory committee. Important as those inputs were, it was the collective momentum of the profession. And what we decided early on in our deliberations was that we had to go to the profession. And that's what we did, to find out what do health educators do in practice. I'm going to quickly show you the four CUP research questions. These questions emerged from our deliberations in 1998 through 1999, and we spent a lot of time establishing these four. The generic role of entry-level health educators, the generic areas of responsibility, competencies, subcompetencies of advanced level health education specialists, the commonalities and the differences. The four RQs drove everything that we did. And I can say to everyone who's in this room, there is really no other way to do it if you're going to be based on good science. And obviously, there are practitioners in here who believe in that, who practice that every time you mount an empirical effort. So I can truly tell you it was worth the effort to make sure that the RQs, the research questions, were properly phrased and directed from the outset. I also want to clearly emphasize that we looked at all settings where health educators practice. These that you see include the major settings that came about for our research, and the other setting does have a collective grouping of settings that are very important. And I do want you to know that you can actually go back to our original data if there's a particular setting that you're interested in. By contacting NCHEC, you can actually go back and you can draw from our data, which are now secondary data that you can use for additional study. Now, I always look at this slide, which has to do with the questionnaire, and I always want to applaud those of you who took the time to complete it. It was a 19-page questionnaire, three parts as you see here, and part A had to do with rating the competencies that were derived from many different sources and numbered 180. The various ratings that were used for those 180 statements is what led, after the data analysis, to the 163 sub-competencies that I mentioned to you were in the end result of the competencies update project. We also, in the B part, wanted to assess the responsibilities of health educators, and you'll notice that we wanted to look at the 10 areas of responsibility, and that included the graduate level areas of responsibility, and then their supervisory involvement, and then, thirdly, the demographic data. But accolades to those of you who, on behalf of the profession, completed this survey. In addition, I do want to point out, if you'll look at the bottom row and the far side column to the right side, you'll notice that we did have a total response rate of 70.6%. And having a 70.6% response rate on a, in this case, a hard copy survey is remarkable. It's the only way to state it. And when we get over 50%, we let out a cheer in any type of empirical research. But this, to us, demonstrated the commitment of the profession to make sure that this had accuracy and eventually validity. You'll also notice that we started with 16 states. We could have projected for the nation, that was a representative sample, four distinct states from each of the four regions of the United States. It was a representative sample with a p-value of 0.05, and it would have projected very nicely for the United States. But we said, to be absolutely sure, why not include every state in the nation and the District of Columbia? And that's the second set of 34 plus one that you see. So we can, I think, feel very good about the data that emanated from the 50 states and the District of Columbia being reflective of the practitioners of the profession. The point that I would like to make here is if you will look at the school row and all the way to the end, you'll notice the percentage in the total column, 25% of the sample did come from schools. And we went into this wanting to reflect and represent the key settings to include the school settings. And of course, the focus today is on the school setting and the application of the responses. Here is the CUP hierarchical model. And again, I will reemphasize, this model is based upon the empirical evidence, both qualitative analysis and quantitative. And I can tell you we used both parametric and non-parametric statistics appropriately. And the conclusions came about again and again in terms of triangulating into this CUP hierarchical model. For entry level, many of you are familiar with this. It has to do with an experience level of less than or equal to 5 years of experience, and it actually is less than 5 years of experience that we use as the gradient point here. The interesting thing is that in terms of educational training, it was either baccalaureate or master's, and individuals talked with us and they said, are you sure? You know, shouldn't it be more baccalaureate? But what we held to was that the empirical evidence was telling us it was either or, okay? So that both were at that entry level in terms of their responses. At Advanced 1, it was Equal to or more than 5 years of experience, baccalaureate or master's. And then at the advanced two level, doctorate of 5 or more years of experience with a doctoral level degree. And importantly, as we develop areas of application, whether it's professional development, credentialing, or professional preparation, it's critically important that we employ this information based upon the national research to the degree that we're able. And we do that in our own programs at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, and we encourage colleagues across the nation to do so. These are the areas of responsibility: to assess, to plan, to implement, to evaluate, to administer, to serve as a resource person, and to communicate and advocate for the for health and health education. And again, these are very much in alignment with the original seven competencies. And it tells us that the original work was very much on target. I'm going to just, for the sake of time, just take one particular area of responsibility. It's four. It's an area that we don't tend to see a lot of attention given to unless we're in a training mode and in a direct action mode as health educators. And it's the one that sometimes is considered the more difficult for students to really get their hands around, to conduct evaluation and research related to health education. But what could be more important? What could go more to the core of our profession than making sure that we have good, solid evaluation skills? You'll notice competency A, developing plans for evaluation and research. And I'm going to track the entry and also the advanced one and the advanced two. Competency B, we have the entry level subcompetencies that you see described. I'm not going to track competency B, but in a moment I'll track competency A at the entry, advanced one, and advanced two levels. Importantly, the alignment of the subcompetencies that you see over here, the alignment of the subcompetencies have to do with skill sets that we need to be about as health educators. We need to be training individuals to be very good at. Although I have to tell you this, with the competencies update research, we didn't intentionally want to get into to what degree of skill, okay? And we do mention that because that would be a marvelous area for follow-up research. Not only what do health educators do in practice, but to what degree of proficiency. If you will, just track with me, first of all, the significance of application of the competencies update research for professional development. So I'm taking one domain. Please keep in mind professional preparation and credentialing, important domains of application. But what could we do in professional development? And as I talk with my colleagues, not only at our university but elsewhere, there are some areas that we can focus on in terms of new competencies needed by health educators for the current and future job market. The competencies coming out of our research enable those new competencies to be considered by employers. Next, additional competencies that health educators should acquire through continuing education and professional development to enhance their skill sets, to sharpen and refine, and then to differentiate entry and advanced levels of practice within health education. Just as recently as yesterday, I had an individual from another profession ask me if we can actually clearly differentiate between entry and the more advanced levels of skills, and we can. And it's not to say that we're trying to super refine what we do as health educators, but if we're being called upon in practice to demonstrate these skills, we need to be ready and we need to prepare our candidates to be ready. Well, let's take a look at professional development for school health at the entry level. Competency A, think back to the hierarchical model, develop plans for evaluation and research. Again, this is not one that people leap to address. They typically have an assignment or an alignment that they're trying to address. Synthesize information presented from the literature. This is the competency going from competency A going down to the subcompetency of synthesizing. And here's an example of what actually has been done and could be done. A school health professional conducts a meta-analysis, looking at several different sources and doing a trend analysis across those sources of professional journals for quantitative assessment of the impact of a particular health issue, such as levels of depression, which would be an important area for us to address in high school students. So could a teacher in a classroom conduct a meta-analysis? Definitely. Okay. Is that something that would be considered necessarily unless there was an encouragement to do so by the administration or through continuing education programs? We would like to stress that we should find ways to encourage these skill sets to be practiced. Another one that I'd like to show to you as an example is the advanced one level. Again, the competency is to develop plans for evaluation and research. And when we talk about the subcompetency, look at this. Develop an inventory of existing valid and reliable tests and survey instruments. And obviously, the distinction between validity, accuracy, and reliability, consistency, comes out here. And that's an important skill for professionals in health education to be aware of. An example, again, an actual example, school health professionals participate in an in-service session to critique new assessments for a particular health issue. Dietary patterns, physical activity, depression, substance use, misuse, and abuse. Importantly, this type of in-service could be conducted, and if we did conduct this in-service, I would suggest that CECHs for CHES certification be applied, and we have done so. And then finally, as an example, as I come toward the end of the presentation and the prepared remarks, and as we prepare to go into a Q&A session, at the Advanced 2 level, develop plans for evaluation and research, and the subcompetency assess the merits and limitations of qualitative and quantitative methods. Well, I think you're seeing that we're moving into a higher level of experience here and training. But what if, and this is projected, I must tell you that this one is projected, but I would love to facilitate this session, I must tell you. School health professionals meet in a discussion-oriented session to deliberate the distinctions among deductive theory, and keep in mind that with the deductive theory, we're talking about concepts. We go from these broad concepts, okay, and then we derive specificity. Oh, that's such a rich area to get into. Inductive theory, where we actually start with data sets, and then we derive the conceptual or the more general perspective. So we go from the more specified data sets into something more general and collective. And then get this. And this is an area where we don't see a lot of attention, but I bet there are people in this room who have accomplished work in grounded theory. Grounded theory is the combination of inductive and deductive research, and it's systematic. And it's one of the more systematic approaches to social research. This would be an area in delving into qualitative and quantitative methods that would be rich. It would absolutely be rich, not only in discussion, but with examples and then with application. Well, I think that the point has been made in terms of how the work and the derivations from the research can be applied, particularly to school health and particularly in the area of professional development. I must go back to the acknowledgement of all of those who contributed to this research. I think we do our best work when it's collective. And I would say that that's inherent. I tend to believe that that's inherent in our profession. We work the best when we're working collaboratively and collectively. We had a national advisory committee, as I've mentioned before. We had a data analysis group who brought to bear their experiences and insights. And we had individuals who were willing to give their time and effort to go through a 19-page questionnaire and respond to the point of 70.6%. As I show you this final slide, which has to do with how you can derive more information through published literature, also through website, one of the ways that I look at the competencies update research harkens back to a statement that was made many years ago, several decades ago, but I believe is very apropos for the competencies update project research and its applications today and in the future. And that statement is that a rising tide lifts all boats. And I would say in the realm of follow-up related to the original research, which was conducted in the late 70s and early 80s, followed up on in 1998 through 2004, I would suggest that that rising tide has to do with our reaching out to practicing professionals and listening to their feedback in terms of what they actually do in practice. Thank you.
Well, in both of these presentations, you know, we often hear the terminology evidence-based practice, right? These are both examples of practice-based evidence. We turn that around. Why do we always have to try and replicate that which somebody else has done? Why don't we do some new things and see if they work? And if they work, now it turns around, doesn't it? Okay. Question.
I have the good fortune of working with Larry and kind of hearing some of the conversations that were taking place, and I found the kind of work is extremely impressive. It's unheard of from a statistical standpoint to have a response rate this high. So I really am very impressed. I congratulate you on your effort. I think it's magnificent what you have done. One of the things that I find is striking is that you started with about 16 states plus one, and then you went to about 38 plus one. And I don't know whether that is by design, people have responded, and from the responses, these were the states that were identified, or whether you intended nationwide.
That's a great question, and let me mention that we started with the idea of having the four regions of the United States well represented, and we found
posterity.
Thank you. The question had to do with the two-stage research that we conducted with the 16-state sample first, and then the 34 plus one, the one being the District of Columbia, secondly, as a secondary analysis. And whether or not we intended to do it that way, actually went into this thinking about getting responses from all of the 50 states and the District of Columbia. if we went into the research that way, or if it emerged, and in actuality it's the latter, it emerged. We went into this trying to make sure that we had a representative sample, and we went through the calculations and we found that if we had four randomly selected states from each of the four regions, and here's something else, and I appreciate the question so much, here's something else that I didn't mention during the presentation. Two of those states in each region had a high level of health educators practicing in their states, and two of those states in each region had a lower level of practicing health educators. And we randomly selected those within each of the regions. We believed that, and actually demonstrated statistically, that with the original sample that we had of 16 states, again, four from each of the regions, we demonstrated that there was a sufficient p-value, and it wasn't weak at all. It was a sufficient p-value to give us the power to say that we actually had a representative sample with that cluster. While we were at it, we said we've got some marvelous data, and if you notice the percentage, it was a very high percentage for the 16 states. And we said, and it was not along the lines of while we're at it, not at all. We said that we could make a more definitive, a stronger statement if we actually continued into the other 34 states plus the District of Columbia, and we're so glad we did. But it was an evolution rather than part of the original plan.
Let me respond to that, too. And the reason I'm moving over here is because they are recording the session. Another thing that happened during that process is there are a lot of ways to do role delineations. Expert panels, the use of just lists of members of professional organizations. And we identified early on, by using a number of these things, that we would have missed a lot of the school people had we not gone to the state-level data. And so what we wanted to do is, in the other states, the 34 plus 1, we did take, in fact, the membership rosters of all of the national professional health education organizations and randomly selected from those people and did that comparison. But had we not gone in-depth in the 16 states, we would have missed so many of the school people. If you take a look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics data, they don't list school health educators. They don't break that out. They don't break that out as a separate group. What were they, something like two or something like that? I think we won. 20. And out of all the health educators, and there are only 20 school health educators. Wrong. So we did have some. The biggest part of doing any of these kinds of studies is planning. And there was a lot of planning that went into it. The other thing that Gary didn't mention, and I'm not saying that to pat anybody on the back, but we publicized the heck out of this. We developed a logo. Every piece of communication that went out carried that logo. We did not vary from it. We kept the profession informed of this. We made presentations on a very regular basis, so we publicized this highly. We had a strategy that we instituted at New Mexico State, that we had all of these postcards. They went out. 2 weeks later, a reminder card went out. 2 weeks after that, another card went out. Everything went to a third party. It was all business reply envelopes and so forth, which actually, in the long run, saved us money. And this is something you have to think about in terms of your research. Do you put stamps on everything and not get them returned because people will take their knife? That's illegal, by the way. You take your knife and you peel the stamp off and use it on something else. People will do this. But if you put a business reply, it costs you an extra 5 to 7 cents when it comes back, but you only pay for those ones that you get back, so you save money in the long run, depending on the size of your sample. Something to think about. So there are a lot of methodological considerations. I mean, Gary's written textbooks in the area of doing research and methodological research, and we applied, I think, every principle of research that's ever been written in this study. And we were not going to sacrifice scientific accuracy for a shortcut. We just weren't going to do it. Other questions? Please, sir.
So When can we expect the Advanced 1 and Advanced 2 exams to roll out?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Dixie, I don't know if Gary's on the commission, and Dixie, I think you're on, too.
I can respond.
Probably 2011 will be, but it'll be Advanced 1 and Advanced 2 are together.
They will not be separate.
And Dixie is the incoming chair of the NCHEC Commission, so she'd be a good individual to make contact with while you're here, and she's here. But if you will go to the NCHEC booth, there is a summary sheet of the advanced examination and its format, and they're still deliberating on the format at this time. Dixie? And I must say, individually, as a practitioner, I am a total advocate for our having this type of certification at the advanced level. I think our profession is calling for it as well.
It's going to change the way we do professional preparation. There's no question.
I have a question for Karen while I'm at the microphone. Karen, in your slides, you indicated when you went over the coursework that there was out-of-class work. I'd be interested in knowing what you and your colleagues came up with related to out-of-class work. I noticed also that only one individual was involved in field work, and would you comment on that as well?
Let me do the easier one first, which is the field work. People didn't see that it would help them pass the test, which, of course, is not the case if you run field work. I'm sure the way you do and the way we like to do it, which is it goes with a seminar and students talk with each other and you talk about the principles and you're reiterating things, but That's pretty much what happened. The out-of-class work, besides generic homework, relates to the kinds of projects that we had students do. And they were to go to meetings and sit in on group discussions and go to different organizations and watch how they process things. They were doing research to write up grants, this kind of thing. There was a lot of work. But I know that they had just been hoping that it would just be come to class, listen, and if you were present for 37.5 hours, it would be enough. I think since the time this has started, I myself have had the pleasure of getting more involved with distance learning, and we started using Blackboard at Kingsborough, which has been an amazing experience, and in terms of doing quizzes, having discussions, having them go view videos and then write assignments, the kinds of things that you can give out of class is really wonderful. I'm struck by two different presentations that I saw either at SOFIA or APHA while I was here, one which said that there is no digital divide any longer, that it's all sort of melding and it's not there, and another one saying, oh no, it's still there. I think it's absolutely essential that, I think it was Jay Bernhardt that was saying that we all have to go mobile and we have to do all these things, which was accentuating the divide, whereas an earlier speaker said there wasn't. I think we have to think of what we mean by out-of-class work. I think we could do, for example, the photo voice where you go out and you take the pictures and stuff like that on your camera and do some really creative kind of work as opposed to sitting down at the computer and doing more research things. One of the things that has been my experience, I just love talking about this, so I'm really sorry, is at a community college, I have never had to be a better teacher than I am at a community college, because learning is such a challenge for this group because of what they do. And I think this has been the same thing. We will have a variety of different kinds of populations who will choose to go this route, at least I hope they will. And for each of those groups, there are going to be different teaching techniques that are going to be used. And so it's not going to be able to be a cookie-cutter kind of a model that you say, oh, I'll take the Winthrop experience and I'll just replicate that in another kind of city. You're going to have to know your cohort and manage your teaching accordingly. Does that address?
Yeah, very nice.
Thank you. I have a question for you two parents who don't leave the microphone. I think I can probably project that they can pick this up. Your online material with Blackboard, is that primarily synchronous or asynchronous work?
There wasn't any at the time. What it will be in the future will be asynchronous. Okay.
I would certainly make that as a suggestion if you're going to do these kind of things, that you can record these types of things, but one of the advantages of the asynchronous classroom is the fact that you can reach people who can't, for whatever reason, come to a, quote, traditional classroom. And if you do everything synchronous, that means that they have to pull that time away from whatever. So I would be a strong advocate of the asynchronous process.
Can I just want to say one thing. Just in case you care, but you didn't want to ask, when I called 2 months ago getting ready for this, it was a bad day. People were being fired, people who I had known and grown to care about, because I came at the beginning and then I came for the CHES review at the end. The 5 of the 8 people who stuck it out trying to pass that exam one last time, I mean, Kenny, who missed it by 3 points, I mean, it was just... It was just horrible. And the day I was working with the school district, and I just need to get this data straight. I just need to know. And it was, Ken, honey, you need to call us back later. We're having a tough time today. We're busy. And I said, you know, my brisk Brooklyn, oh, I'm sorry, you know, it's a bad time. And then she said, Kenny's going, and this one's going, and that one's going. And the two of us, we just cried on the phone. I should also mention, by the way, because life happens, that one of our participants developed breast cancer and treated it throughout the entire program. Never dropped out, passed the exam.
Other questions? The sign-up sheet, if you want more information about school health and services section, is right here. Thank you. Have a wonderful conference. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming.
Throughout the state, including Livonia, Michigan, Lansing, Michigan.
Oh, you're all over.
All over.
All wonderful.
Locations. But they are trying to begin to move on to a more central campus in Grand Rapids. Bottom line is, you know, I have an MPH with 30 years behind it. And the CHES exam is all new territory for me, because my specialty was is epidemiology.
Take care of yourself.
Thank you, Larry. You
infectious disease
epidemiology. I'll see you. Thank you for sitting through.
So I need to know how to link in to the whole profession of health education. I mean, in my MPH program at U of M, you know, health behavior and education was just one of many courses and areas we had to study. We had to study everything, even though I'm an MPH major. So I need to know more about it, because we are thinking of bringing it in as a post-bac certificate program. My question is also, can
that would be a great way to do
associate, obviously you teach at community colleges, college, so it's an associate degree in your program?
We have community health, not health education,
right,
as a degree, with the understanding that it just opens up some doors that they're going to need to know more.
So they would still even have to take additional courses before they could sit for the exam? Because
all
nine courses can't possibly fit into that
right,
curriculum.
And okay. You must have a bachelor's degree.
Oh, you have to have a bachelor's.
You
okay.
must have
can't
the bottom line.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
It could be in anything.
Yeah.
Plus the...
Well, I don't even
25
think, you know, I just don't know how I brush up, but, you know, I have an MPH, and my doctorate's work is in adult learning theory.
But this is the kind of program that I think a variety of people, I have a girlfriend who teaches in a school, and she's supervising these phys ed teachers in teaching health ed. The headmaster's part who wants to hire them because they want to do real health ed, and these guys aren't qualified. And she might have been talking to
I've been teaching, you know, I was in hospital infection control, and that's what I've been doing for 30 years. So,
okay.
You know, I'm transitioning out of healthcare, obviously, into academia now. So. I'm thinking I probably would qualify for the exam myself.
Well, they'd have to look at your transcript.
They'd
have to bring them all in, and they'd have to look.
Statistics.
But you, if you look at the framework.
And then my doctoral study, which is a doctorate in education.
Right. But health education does have its unique attributes.
Sure, sure.
And so, again, if you would want to look at this, you should see the framework, and then you should decide. But I think to coordinate something in Michigan for everybody who's interested and pick a university or do it yourself, host this thing and arrange to have the nine courses taught either, again, mixed with what's already on campus or do it with a partner organization.
I'd like to find out what's going on in the Leland-Perry.
Central Michigan, I mean, have you looked at them? That's a wonderful school. There's lots of people you could partner with.
For sure.
And I think once word got out that there was a certificate program, okay, so it's nine courses.
So I should see who else may even have one already in Michigan.
Nobody's going to have a certificate program at this point. What they have are majors.
Yes.
And then the question is, most of them, if they're worth their salt, as Gary was saying, they've evaluated their programs to make sure that their courses, they may do it in four or five courses, they may divide it up differently, address all the
competencies. Okay.
And that's a way to go. And then if it's not there, then the question is, can you bring it in and can you coordinate it yourself?
If I could have one of your cards.
Absolutely. I'm doing
it. I'm actually going to be transitioning from Associate Dean of Allied Health over to the MPH because it's a brand new program we're just rolling out.
Wait, hang on one second.
And it is available totally online, so.
That's really interesting.
Oh, yeah.
No.
I'm talk about the divide, you know, I haven't jumped on the bandwagon to teach online. I'm not that comfortable just yet.
No, and it takes some doing.
It
to do
does.
It right, it's different.
I haven't used
to
Blackboard for 6 years, but it's different to be your only source of contact.
Okay.
So I'm going to look for the booth down in the exhibit area.
Yes.
I thought that's my next step.
That's a really good next step.
Plus, I think I'd like to include a course on health education in our MPH program because we have health behavior.
Well, influences health behavior and how you do it.
Let's see. I want to see some textbooks and see what I can find too.
All right. I mean, it's a wonderful, besides being a great thing to major in general, it's
right.
a great adjunct for people who are assumed to be providing that service anyway,
right.
and they've never learned how to.
Mm-hmm.
Not the
learning theory.
No, not at all, and not, you know, being able to evaluate the resources and look at them and all the other things that Gary pointed out.
Right,
they don't know how to do a needs assessment, community or individual, or they might for their profession. But from a health education point of view, all these things are specific and essential.
Right.
For
and that's the stuff I studied in my doctoral program, is needs assessment, program evaluation. I mean, I'm an epidemiologist.
Right. So,
anyway.
No.
But now in a social science context, yeah.
Right.
Well, thank you. This was very interesting. Thank you so
much. Well, I'm
much.
So glad you came. Thank
First
you.
I think I have your card as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Beverly Mello, I'm a new Associate Dean for Allied Health and transitioning to the MPH program. I'm so excited. That's why I'm in the process. This was being looked at like a year or so ago for the post-bac. And now with my new role in my doctoral work at my new performance technology agency for the College of Education at Wayne State University, I'm looking at transfer of training in the healthcare setting because we do such an abysmal job of it. Like, what are we missing? What are the barriers? So that's what my studies.
I lost them. I stuck them in here. I wish I did. I stuck them in here. Okay, I will do that. Start up some dialogue going.
Absolutely. I'm always such an advocate for programs.
Okay. Well, yeah, then I'm
going to get to a level that is literally going to make a difference.
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
I'd like to do it, you know, in team because we just rolled out the MPH this fall.
Oh, sweet.
It's available. It is technically available fully in seat or online. Yeah, quite honestly, the in seat is really going to be a high. Very interesting. It's a new concept for me. So that first night, you would just come for a couple of hours. And then you'd only come to class every other session over a 15-week. And then the other sessions would be online. We're using the basically, it's handing you his online course. So, anyway, and I've worked for 30 years in hospital epidemiology infection control, so I've been doing this teaching. You know, community work, I've been involved with the mission group, community health, disaster preparedness with our professional association of infection control on the board, you know, nationally, locally. So I do so many things. I really wanted a PhD in health behavior education, but U of M still requires you pretty much full time, and that wasn't possible. So that's why it's awesome to teach them in education.
Well, and you're able to bring those vantage points now.
It's all coming together. And it is. It's more a learning theory than U of M would have probably provided. So
it was a pleasure.
Thank you so much. This was a great session. Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Sessions, I've talked to colleagues with 3 and 4 people.
Wow.
And then, in addition, it's San Diego.
Indeed. Typically a large draw.
Well, a large draw, but not for the meeting.
Yes.
They're all watching the boats. Thank you.
to be conversational.
It really is.
You know what I think we're allowed to do? It's okay. I mean, I have a series of questions that they don't hear. So, and the questions probably can get responded to, but I'd like to do it. Just say, you answer the question and see if there's any.
How's it running, bud?
Tell the audience and then do it that way. I don't know how long or any people will do this, but it's not longer than that. To look at the boats.
Or jump in the pool.
You know, I think he's kind of,
Well, yeah, the emphasis.
Well, I don't know if it's just people in the community.
I can't read this.
Yes, I did find it, and I'm just looking for the books. So I'm just seeing if they've been brought up here or if they're being.
I'll go down with you.
You want to come or wait?
Yeah, okay. I'll keep walking till I can. Yeah, okay. All right. Oh, here they are. Okay, hurry up. Okay.
Right, we're going to go to bed.
Yeah, sure. You certainly have time. I think that you should do. Especially, I mean, the whole point is originally, even if we were
just coming down and spending the night,
and
we'll go
very
out.
Interactive. This is great, and I'm going to bring the books and put them out here along with.
I know.
So great. You know, I downloaded this actually from your website, but I didn't know it was actually printed, so I'm going to take it out.
She's a professional writer.